All right, there is hand sanitizer, I think, in the back over there if you do want some. I was told that might be a good idea for some of us, so feel free to do that. I apologize if you wake up tomorrow morning and you are sick. Go ahead and give me a call, and I will pray with you and apologize profusely. We're going to start this morning with this idea of grieving, and I thought it was fitting for New Year's Day, you know, New Year's Eve, to do something on grieving anyway. But I think it's also important, again, to just review some things as we move forward. And my hope with all of this, in this whole idea with grieving, was to begin to just start to think differently. What we're going to start with here is a fairly lengthy introduction. So if you think, are we ever going to get to the sermon, just hang with me. This introduction is a little lengthy, but I think it's helpful for us to also review where we're at. And I feel like I try to do that regularly, I try to do that often, is try to I try to review where we're at and what we're doing in our world. And this comes from a book by John James and Frank Cherry. And they write this book on grief recovery about a boy named Johnny. Okay, so as you listen to Johnny's story, what I hope you do, and what I tried to do as well, is to see where do we relate, where do we connect with his story in our own grieving process and our losses that we've experienced. So the story of Johnny begins as a five-year-old. This five-year-old Johnny has his dog die. And his dog passes away, and he's stunned. He burst out crying. His dog had been his constant companion, slept at the foot of his bed, and now the dog is gone, and Johnny's just a basket case. And so the dad doesn't know maybe quite what to do. Johnny's dad stammers a little bit, and he says, "Oh, you know, Johnny, don't feel bad, Johnny. We'll get you a new puppy on Saturday," right? And so Johnny gets this new puppy, and in this one sentence, Johnny's dad basically taught him two of the first two steps of grief management in our society. The first is bury your feelings. The second is replace the loss. Bury your feelings, replace your losses. And once that new dog comes into the picture, especially for a five-year-old, the old dog is a little bit forgotten, and the process has moved forward. A little while down the road, Johnny falls in love with a high school freshman, and for a while, right, his world never seemed brighter. Everything was going great and wonderful until she dumps him, right? And he has a sudden, suddenly these curtains basically cover the sun, and Johnny's heart is broken. Maybe part of the relationship hurt, you know, the relationship ending hurt, but the hope and the future maybe is part of the loss as well. And this is a big-time hurt for him. It's not just a dog. This is a person that he had emotions fixed on and had a connection to. John is a wreck, but Mom comes to the rescue, and she says with great sensitivity, "Well, don't feel bad, John. There are other fish in the sea." And so, again, he's learning this idea of burying the pain and replacing the loss. Johnny has these two steps, these first two steps down pretty pat by now, and he'll use them the rest of his life. Much later then, John's grandfather passes away, the one he had spent every summer fishing with, really had a close connection to. A note was slipped to him in math class that gave him this news, and he reads the news and he tries to hold it together, but he just can't, and he starts just bawling in the middle of class. And his teacher, feeling uncomfortable, decides that Johnny needs to go. John needs to go down to the office to grieve alone. When John's father comes to pick him up, he brings him home, and John sees his mother crying, weeping on the couch even, and he wants to go and weep with her and sit there with her and grieve with her. But his dad says, no, don't disturb her, John. She needs her time alone. Why don't you go down in your room for a while? She'll be okay after a little bit, and then you two can talk. And quickly, John then learns here the third piece of the grieving puzzle is to grieve alone. To grieve alone. And so John does go to his room alone and feels this deep sense of loneliness. Eventually, he buries those feelings, replaces the loss of his grandfather with a whole host of athletic involvement, activities, things to be involved with. And we would probably commend that choice, right? Because there's other options available to burying those feelings, right, than to do something active and purposeful. But he functions, he tries to function as normally as he can. But even many months later, he constantly keeps thinking about his grandpa, right? The fishing trips, the Christmas Eves, the birthdays, all these different things. And this preoccupation goes on for months until he finally tells his dad about it. And his dad says, you know what, John, just give it time. Just give it time. Translation, time heals in and of itself. So he's learned the fourth step here in grief management. So if we're keeping track, first we bury our feelings. Next we replace our losses. Third we grieve alone. And fourth we give it time, because time alone can heal it. All right. John gave it more and more time, but somehow he just still felt trapped in the cell of sadness. He just continued to grieve this loss of his grandfather. And what made it worse is he kept reliving that relationship with his grandfather, thinking about all the experiences that they had, but even more so, all the experiences that he failed to have. He would remember the sack lunches, the late afternoon swims, during the fishing trips. And one thing, though, he felt he just never was able to say. He never was able to tell his grandfather, I love you. And John said to himself, well, what can I do about it now? I'll just have to live with that regret the rest of my life. And that became the fifth piece in his philosophy towards grief management. If it's unfinished business, just plan to live with the regret the rest of your life. And so as you can imagine, with all this trauma, John just needs to do a little bit of elementary math that in order for him not to feel that pain, he makes this decision. He says, close relationships, they just expose me to the possibility of deep pain. Therefore, the way to make sure that this kind of anguish is never experienced again, I'm just going to keep everyone and everything at arm's length. Translation is step six, wall up and never trust again. Don't get so close to people that when they leave or when they're absent or when we lose something that we never feel that deep pain again. The sixth step makes the conventional grief management approach complete. And so in review, right, we have these six. Bury the feelings. Replace the losses. Grieve alone. Let time heal. Live with the regret. And never trust again. So does that sound familiar to anyone? I know I've given advice that sounds pretty similar to that, right? Or suggested things like that. I've thought those kind of things. I've grieved that way. But the thing is that when we work through that, we continue to carry those wounds around in us. We continue to carry that. It distorts basically really the way that we live the rest of our lives, the daily lives. And so I hope there was some part of you that maybe related to that. And if not, you're in the minority, because 85% of us, 85% of us deal with grief in similar ways to Johnny. Maybe not all of those steps all the time, but in a similar way. Whether it's the loss of a parent, a child, a friend. And I would even say, and we'll talk about that this morning too, is not just the loss of someone we care about, but something that we wanted, right? A hope or a dream, a future, an anticipation. Maybe even something that we didn't know about ourselves, a certain identity that we feel like we've lost. And so we go through this, and most of us, again, fall into these patterns of dealing with loss this way. And so my prayer and my hope this morning is that we'll move forward from that, that we'll find ways that we can move forward well. And actually my hope is, and we'll see how this goes, is to kind of be a Debbie Downer all year long and to bring this up over and over again at different times during the year, because I think it's such a reality in our world, right? And we think, well, it's Christmas, everybody's happy and excited at Christmas, or it's New Year's, or it's Thanksgiving, or it's Valentine's Day. Who doesn't love Valentine's Day, right? I mean, that's the favorite time of year for everyone. But, you know, but that's probably when it hits us the hardest sometimes, is having those moments, those celebrations where someone's not there, or we lost something in the last year, or some of those kind of things. And so my hope is to kind of continue this theme throughout the year at different points, but we'll see how it goes. But the first thing I guess I want to point out to us, and this I don't know that this is news to us, but I think it's important to say anyway, is that to grieve is okay. It's actually good to grieve. And it's not like Charlie Good Grief. It's Charlie Brown Good Grief, right? It's good to grieve, to go through that process, to work through that, even if it makes others around us uncomfortable, right? In Johnny's story, I think it's that's how I am too. I get uncomfortable when people are grieving. I'm sure most of us probably do to a certain extent. But it's okay if other people are uncomfortable. We still need to be okay and say it's good for me to grieve. And to be honest with you, I think that's really the first part of processing our grief, is to say that it's okay. And it's maybe we think that and we know that, well, if I lost a parent or I lost a sibling or I lost a child or a spouse, you know, we would say, yeah, that's okay to grieve. But are there other things in our life that it's okay to grieve as well? And I think of like a midlife crisis and going through that. Maybe some of you have experienced that. But I think midlife crisis really is a loss of something, right? A loss of an expectation or a loss of a hope or a loss of, you know, when I'm 20 and 25, I won't have this dream that I'm going to, you know, do all of these things or be this person or have this career. But when we get to 40 or 50 or, you know, beyond, we start to realize that maybe that's not going to come true. And so we start grabbing and we start, you know, we get that cherry red Corvette 2018, you know, with the brown lights, taillights. If I drive one of those around, where I'm at in my life. So, if you didn't know already, but I think again, part of the permission allows us to grieve that way, right? Or to allow ourselves to grieve is giving us ourselves that permission, and allowing others to be uncomfortable with that. When we were back in Minnesota, we had started this program, basically like our family night, and Michelle and I were both instrumental in starting it and getting it going and leading it. And after a few years of meeting together and doing things, when it ended, I took the loss so much deeper than she did. I had a much deeper sense of loss, a much deeper sense of pain than she did. And in that context and in that situation, I think we both did pretty well. She allowed me to work through it, even though she was at a different stage and a different level of grief than I was. And I don't, at that point in time, I don't think I tried to pull her into my grief. Sometimes we do that. I've done that with other situations with her. You don't feel bad enough. I'm going to pull you into my junk here right now, kind of a situation. But I think it's okay to, she's going to grieve differently than I'm going to grieve in the same context, right? Siblings grieve differently when a parent passes away, right? And we all grieve differently too, and that's okay too. Grief is a individual thing, but it's also a communal thing as well. The other thing I think it was important and healthy for us to work through as we dealt with that loss was to just start digging a little deeper in it as well, is why does that feel like a loss? Why is that situation there? And I'll talk more about that here as we move forward. But we often teach ourselves, or we've been taught, that grief is a thing that we just need to get over. It's an interruption in our life that I need to deal with it, or I need to push it aside so I can get back to real life or to regular life. Right, we allow ourselves a certain amount of time, but then it's getting back to what we're supposed to be doing. And we even could probably look, and there are pastors I know that have done this, that look at grief as a waste of time. Right, you need to get through it, you need to move forward so that you can do the things. And there's biblical passages, maybe you could even say, point to that to a certain extent. But even, again, the loss of a dream, the loss of an ideal, something hypothetical, I think is an important thing to grieve as well. A Christian counselor, and I wish I would have put this on the board for you because I just love what she says. And I don't know her name, but I just, because I got it from a book. But this Christian counselor says this for advice for individuals she counsels. She says, of course I tell them to feel their feelings. But then I urge people to reduce radically the pace of their lives. Says, I urge them to review their loss, talk about it openly, think about it thoroughly, write about it reflectively, and pray through it. She continued, it's my experience that people want to run from their pain. They want to replace the pain with another feeling as soon as they can. To recover from pain, we have to face it. We must stand in it and process it before it will dissipate. That's God's way. That's our natural reaction, to run away from the pain, to fill the void. You know, John's story where he felt the loss, he got involved in athletics, right? Replacing that pain, getting a new dog. That's our natural reaction. But God says, or the counselor, in God's way is to actually recover from the pain. We need to face it. We need to work through it in order for it to dissipate. And I just think that's such a true statement. And so this New Year's, right, I apologize that it's a little bit of a Debbie Downer this morning, but again, I think it's such an important part of where we're at. And maybe some of you are at this point where it is more of a grief process, where you're dealing with pain or whatever in your life at this point in time as well, but such an important topic, I think, as well as we move forward. And so this morning, we're going to look at three other steps. I already talked kind of about the purposefulness of understanding it's okay to grieve, but these are three other things that I think are important for us to realize before we move forward in our grief. And the next thing is to pay attention. To pay attention. And basically, this is kind of what I said earlier, but I think it's on a more purposeful and a deeper level. When we, again, we finished this program, my first reaction was anger. I was angry at everyone and anything involved in that situation. And I'm kind of an angry person anyway. I know it surprises most of you, but you know, my natural reaction is, who can I be angry at? Who can I blame? Who can I attack in order for myself to feel better? And that was my first reaction, and it lasted way too long. I won't tell you how long that lasted. But, you know, then this was a fair example for me to work through this. And then my next reaction was to figure out, why am I so angry? Why is there such this reaction to this situation? And I started to dig deeper beyond fear, because anger is a secondary emotion. It's always some reason. There's always something behind that anger. And as I dug deeper, I started to realize things about myself. That a lot of my anger and a lot of my frustration, a lot of my hurt from that situation came because of who I was and how I viewed myself. And in that situation, I felt like a failure. I felt like I was worthless. I felt like I didn't matter. I felt like, what's the point of trying and doing anything? And so that all those negative things just piled up on top of me in that situation and in that context. But in order for me to move forward and to process that, again, I needed to dig beneath the surface. I needed to dig beyond just being angry. And I just got to thinking, too, as far as paying attention to these things, is part of this is time as well, and just allowing ourselves the time to work through this and to pay attention to how we're feeling. And I got to thinking, I know there's sometimes guilt that gets tied to not working through these things well or quickly enough, I guess, right? If we look at our culture, maybe, right, our culture would say if you lose someone that's close to you, a spouse or a parent or someone close to us, you get a week off. Is that maybe fair? Maybe I'm cynical a little bit with this, right? We get kind of a week off, right? You can take a week, then you need to get back to work and back to your regular schedule and back to everything else. And I would say that that is a terrible way to look at loss, because if we think about it, and then even after you get back to work, right, you have 6 months, you have a year, maybe a little bit longer. Once you get through all the major holidays, then you need to start feeling better. You should be more over it, whatever that looks like or whatever that means. But I would, you know, argue and say that it's such a big, you know, if it's someone that you've known, you know, and been close to, married to, a parent, whatever, for 30, 40, 50 years, why would we ever think that in a year things would get back to normal, that things would be, everything would be smooth? And not saying we should wallow in that grief, not saying that we should have the same intensity of the loss a year or two or 5 years later, but if we've known someone, been close to someone for that long, why would we ever think we should rush through that? And why should we feel the guilt that's tied to that at times? And so again, paying attention to how we feel is something that, again, is so important for us to realize and to work through. I've had other experiences. The last church that I worked at, and leaving that as well, both sides, everybody involved knew that it was good that I would leave, that I should leave that situation in that context. But there was still a loss for me when I left. There was still a pain that I felt in that situation as well. And there are probably different factors, but there's just, you know, those feelings of who I was and how I was, felt like a failure. And so grieving those losses and grieving the things is not always at the surface level. And we see that here, I think, in our Bibles as well. If you want to go to 2 Samuel, the first chapter of 2 Samuel, this man named David, and maybe you've heard of David, King David, the second king of Israel, came to power was coming into his own at this point in time. In the beginning of 2 Samuel, we see King Saul and his son Jonathan being killed in battle. And King David's the next on the throne. He has how many millions of things to do, right? He's supposed to be the next king. He should get things ready to go. He needs to raise his army. He needs to get everything organized. Whatever else a king does at that time, I don't know. Thankfully, I never have to worry about being king, so I don't have to worry about that. But so David probably has 1,000 things, million things to do as King Saul, as Jonathan pass away. But David stops, and I think he kind of stops everybody. Before they move forward, before they jump into the next project, before he becomes and is crowned king, we need to stop and we need to grieve this loss. Jonathan, especially because for David, he had just a good relationship. They were close. But even King Saul, who tried to kill David for much of the past, you know, several years at this time, that the position of a king passing away and the grief that we need to feel in that. And so in 2 Samuel, starting in verse 19, I'm just going to read a portion of the section here through the end of the chapter. David writes this, it's called an elegy, this poem of lament. He says, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on the high places. How the mighty have fallen. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. Again, we see him pay attention to his feelings. We see him talk about how he cared for Jonathan, how he calling Saul and Jonathan both lovely and beloved, and the feelings and the emotion tied to this. And so we see him pay attention to that feeling. Another man, again, that you may know a little bit, Jesus, he lamented and he spent time grieving and paying attention to how he felt. In John 11:35, he goes to visit Lazarus, who has just passed away. And actually, he's going to visit the family, Mary and Martha, Lazarus' sisters, and the others there. And he goes to be there as Lazarus has passed away, his good friend Lazarus has passed away. And when he arrives, we probably have, you know, most of us, if we've memorized anything in the Bible, we can probably memorize this, but memorizing the two words that show up in John 11:35, it says that Jesus wept. And there's probably different reasons that Jesus wept, but he saw the people, and I think it was probably more an compassionate weeping. I don't know what the right word is there, how to say empathetic. Compassionate crying that he felt for those around him as he sees Mary and Martha, as he sees the others crying and mourning. And not only did he weep, right, and I don't know what you think of when you think of weep, but like I think of like he was wailing. I think of like a cartoon where the tears are shooting out kind of a thing. I mean, that's a little too much probably, but the Greek says that he burst into tears. This wasn't a solemn, you know, tears running down his, you know, cheeks. This is a bursting out in crying, and you can see the pain and you can see the expression. No other rabbi, no other leader like Jesus would have ever undignified himself the way that Jesus does here, whether you think that's undignified or not, I guess. But another example comes from Luke 13:34, and in Luke 13:34, again, we see Jesus interacting, and probably more of a compassionate kind of a thing than his actual pain, his own pain. But he goes and he's praying basically over Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is an image for Israel, for the Jews, for his people, his kinsmen. And he just feels frustration probably. He feels anxiety because of what their choices have been. And I think he feels the same way about us. And maybe as a parent, you guys can feel this, right? You see your parent or your child, and you think, why would you do that, right? That is just going to cause you more pain, right? And I told you not to do this, and I'm not going to say I told you so because that doesn't probably helpful. But I do that often. You know, I told you this was going to go. Anyway, so, right, he feels like they need to be making better choices, and he's frustrated, but he's also loving and caring. And he says this in verse 34 of Luke 13. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stone those who were sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. And so we see, again, the compassion and the care and the love and the expression here of Jesus. And lastly, in Matthew 27:46, looking just again at Jesus' words, these are some of his last words as he's hanging on the cross and having gone through, you know, hours of being beaten, of being spit on and mocked, and you know, his back being ripped open, the atrocious things that he experienced. Not only that, but, you know, again, being hung on the cross, you can see the emotional, psychological, even social rejection that he faced. And his response to that is to cry out. And again, this is tied a little bit to, or tied to Psalm 22 a little bit too, but the expression and the openness and the attention that he pays to his pain, and he cries out in his anguish, my God, why have you forsaken me? David, Jesus, so many others in the Bible, if you want to read a book, you know, the book of Job, even the book of Lamentations that Jeremiah writes, we see in the Psalms all over the place this, the attention that is paid to the feelings. And I don't think, and I think again, that's a big part of why we fail to grieve well, is because we just don't pay attention to our grief. We don't pay attention to how we feel. But as we work through that, as we understand that we can pay attention and we start to understand, well, I'm feeling this way because, or this is how I'm feeling, we can go to the next idea, or the next step is to live in the confusing in-between. Live in the confusing in-between. And this, no one wants to do. Not one of us wants to do this. We don't want to sit there. We don't want to wallow in it. We don't want to deal with it. We just want to get to the next thing. Right? It's almost, like I said, it's that hurdle we need to get over. It needs to jump over. It's difficult. It's hard. It's not a natural reaction. We want to run away from the pain. We want to cover the pain. We want to do anything but to sit in the pain and in the grief that we're experiencing. But it's such a big part of the healing process to stop and to really realize that I need to be here for a while, and I need to allow these feelings to kind of hang out before I can move forward into something different. And again, this may mean taking off more time than we're used to. Again, we usually take a week or 2 weeks or something when we lose something significant in our life, someone significant in our life. But maybe it means taking off a day a week for a while. Maybe it means taking off a day a month to just go and focus on just how I'm feeling and what I'm doing, spending that time in the confusing in-between. It looks maybe a little bit like this in John Milton's book, The Paradise Lost. He mentions and shows this comparison between the evil of history and a compost pile. And he talks about how mixing this decaying substance, right, this eggshells, this animal excrement, the vegetables, fruit peels, dead leaves, all of this basically garbage that we're piling together, and when we throw a little bit of dirt on top of it, you know, we start to allow it some time. We start to let it to mix and to mold and to change and to come together. And when we're done, right, we have this rich, nutritious, this fertilized soil that we can use to just grow wonderful crops. And that's the idea of the sitting in the in-between. It doesn't feel good. It probably doesn't smell real good, right? But it's an important part of the cultivating process to be able to grow us and to change us, which brings us to our last step of allowing the old to grow or to become, to birth the new. Allow the old to birth the new. Again, that compost pile, all of those things, all of those feelings, all of those emotions, sitting and allowing those to hang out, not to just hold on to them, but to not just push them away, not to just bury them, but allow them to work through and to allow us to face them, can turn into something wonderful. And I don't have this list on the board either, so you'll have to do your best with it. But I've been reading a lot from this man named Pete Scazzaro, and he does such a wonderful job with emotional health and healing that I've been trying to learn as much as I can and grow as much as I can through it. But in his book, Emotionally Healthy Church, he lists several things that we can get, that things that birth into new if we're allowing ourselves to pay attention to live in the in-between as we grieve loss. And he says this: we become compassionate as our Father in heaven is compassionate. He says, Henry Nouwen says, there's no compassion without many tears, right? We can relate to one another better through our grief. He says, we have greater concern for the poor and the widow, the orphan, the marginalized. We'll become less covetous, less idolatrous. Life is stripped of its pretense and non-essentials. We are liberated, he says, from having to impress others. And I think that would be great for a lot of us. It'd be great for me to live liberated from having to impress others. We are able to live more comfortably with mystery when it comes to God's plan. We are able to place God at the center of our lives, and then we begin rejecting the superficial pursuits. We enjoy a new vivid appreciation for the basic facts of life. And I think this is a huge one for me. We have fewer fears. When we know that God is there and we can work through the pain and the anguish that we might experience, those fears tend to dissipate. And the last one, again, for us together and for me personally is a huge one, is that we understand that what bonds us as followers of Jesus, living in community, is our brokenness. Because we are all just so very different. Different experiences, different jobs, different families, different relationships. And what bonds us all together is our brokenness. And when we can work through and live in our grief and become and go into a new normal, that brokenness can bond us together if we're open and we're paying attention and we're able to share those things. And so thinking about those two ideas, thinking about the world's grief management system versus God's plan for grief management, There's a story I read. I don't think it's really a very old story, and it's a true story, about this man who's driving home from a family function. And in the vehicle are him and his wife, I think two kids, and his mother, and they're driving home, and all of a sudden they see this man come across the center line and this drunk driver hitting them at 70 miles an hour head on. And in that instant he loses his mother and his wife and his four-year-old daughter. And I don't know what you've lost, I don't know what you've experienced for loss, but I can't relate to that kind of a loss. But if I had to work through that kind of a loss, if I had to deal with that type of three generations of women in my life all of a sudden being gone, I don't want to deal with it the way the world does. I don't want to deal with burying my grief. I don't want to deal with replacing the loss and grieving alone, time healing it, living with regret, never trusting again. I want to live and grieve the way that God designed us to grieve, to pay attention, to allow myself to grieve, to pay attention, to live in that in-between, and to allow him to lead me to something, a new normal in that process. It's not easy, and it's definitely not quick, but I feel like it's the way that God designed us and the place that he can be found. Let's pray. Gracious Father, we thank you for your Son. We thank you so much for what you've shown us and what you've provided us, and we just pray that if we allow ourselves to work through grief, whether it's a loss of someone close to us, whether it's a loss of a dream, whether it's a loss of something really, it's almost insignificant, that we can grieve well through your grace and through your plan. And we pray this on your Son Jesus' name. Amen. So this morning as we conclude, the worship team's going to come forward, and we're going to sing a song that just, I think, kind of encompasses this idea. If you know the story behind It As Well and the loss that this writer and author experienced in his life, we know that if nothing else, our salvation and our hope rest in Jesus, no matter what our loss, no matter what our grief. So let's stand together and sing It As Well With My Soul.